In this weekend's episode, three interviews from this past week's Washington Journal. First, CBS News correspondent Scott McFarland discusses the seditious conspiracy sentencing this week of Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes and other members of the anti-government group. Next, 2024 Republican presidential candidate and former Arkansas governor Asa Hutchinson talks about his White House bid and what he sees as his path to victory in an increasingly crowded GOP field. Plus, we get a 101 on Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, a key government surveillance program that expires at the end of the year. That conversation with George Croner, former principal litigation counsel at the National Security Agency and senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Now, CBS News correspondent Scott McFarlane on the significance of the first seditious conspiracy charges for January 6 defendants this week.
Stuart Rhodes got 18 years in jail yesterday. Scott McFarlane, remind viewers who Stuart Rhodes is.
The top line of the 1,000-plus U.S. Capitol riot defendants. He is the founder, the originator of the Oath Keepers, the far-right group which had a big footprint and a big role in the attack on the Capitol. He was charged with seditious conspiracy, this new modern-day group of defendants actually charged with sedition against America. He was accused of plotting and planning the attack, of getting money organized and raised, getting weapons organized and staged outside the D.C. city limits, getting protective military gear for some of those on the front lines. He didn't go into the Capitol, but what the prosecutors argued successfully in securing a conviction for Stuart Rhodes was that he was the brainchild. He was an Ivy League grad, a military service member in his past, a person who was able to get his own fighting force ready to deploy January 6th, convicted at trial by a D.C. jury and then sentenced yesterday to 18 years, the longest sentence so far in any January 6th case, but also the first in this wave of 10 seditious conspiracy defendants convicted at trial and to be sentenced.
And focusing on seditious conspiracy, how many people total have been convicted in a January 6th case, and how many of those have been convicted of seditious conspiracy, this particular charge?
It's a real small subset, John. About 1,000 defendants so far. Roughly half of them have either been convicted at trial or pleaded guilty. So there's a lot more still to come. 10 have been convicted of seditious conspiracy. So you're talking about 1% of the defendants. Stuart Rhodes, again, the first one to be sentenced, not the last one. But that sentence of 18 years really lays down a marker for everybody else still to come. This is something without comparison in modern times, a conspiracy to try to block the peaceful transfer of power in America. So that 18 years is a real foundation.
Prosecutors wanted 25 years, correct? And he got 18. Why?
A few different reasons. The sentencing guideline range was actually 21 to 27 years. And one of the things the federal judge in this case, Amit Mehta, was wrestling with, and he articulated this yesterday, was that there's no real comparison. There's nothing to line it up with to get a good measure as to what's too lenient and what's too strict, because this is kind of a unicorn of a case. He made comparisons to other cases of seditious conspiracy in America, which really were not analogous. They involved some type of violent behavior or violent activity by the defendant, him or herself. Stuart Rhodes was not accused of any violence himself that day. He didn't go into the Capitol. So it was a bit of an amorphous thing trying to figure out how to properly sentence this case, and the judge decided 18 years was spot on.
What should viewers know about Amit Mehta, and how many of these cases has he been involved in?
They have subdivided these 1,000 cases among all of the federal judges here in Washington, D.C. It's worth reminding folks that all of the U.S. Capitol riot cases are being tried right here in the nation's capital. That's where the crime occurred.
Right down the street
from here.
Right
down the street from the Capitol itself. Amit Mehta has had his share of them, but he had the first big one in his courtroom, this Oath Keepers seditious conspiracy trial. It was a lengthy trial with many, many witnesses, many, many victims, including police officers, who explained how January 6th not only damaged democracy, but damaged them. The physical injuries, the trauma, the terror, the loss of police from the force, police officers who stepped away from duty because of January 6th. Judge Mehta oversaw that trial and then handled that first sentencing and then the second sentencing yesterday, too. John, it's worth underscoring that Rhodes' co-defendant, Kelly Meggs, leader of the Florida Oath Keepers, was also sentenced yesterday, for seditious conspiracy, and he got 12 years.
What did Kelly Meigs do that day versus Stuart Rhodes?
Walked into the Capitol itself, which differentiates him from Stuart Rhodes. He was also convicted at trial of being an organizer, a plotter, and a planner of this fighting Oath Keepers force. But Kelly Meigs stepped foot on the Capitol grounds during January 6th. His case was, along with several other Oath Keepers, not just a federal charge, not just a federal crime, but one which the prosecutor said was different than the other rioters or unlawful paraders who were at the Capitol January 6th. There were other Oath Keepers convicted of seditious conspiracy. They'll be sentenced to in the coming days.
Rioters, unlawful paraders, seditious conspiracy. How are these juries breaking down these various charges? Or I guess, how is the federal government choosing to prosecute different folks under different ones of these charges?
Different charges based on what you did at the Capitol that day, according to prosecutors. You can't paint everybody in that mob with a broad brush. Some people truly stepped into the Capitol, looked around, didn't touch anything, didn't injure anyone, didn't push police, then walked out. They're going to get a different charge than somebody who used pepper spray and deployed it in the face and eyes of a police officer. Somebody who stole something, broke something. The man who put his feet on Nancy Pelosi's desk was sentenced to 4.5 years in prison. He faced different charges, was convicted on different charges than somebody who just walked in unlawfully on Capitol grounds, part of a dangerous mob, but didn't hurt anyone or go into a sensitive space.
Richard Barnett is the man who put his feet on Nancy Pelosi's desk. The picture from USA Today showing him along with the story. In terms of how he reacted to his sentencing or how he reacted to the charges, reporting on some defiance in the face of these charges by the government and throughout the trial, how are the judges and the juries treating folks who are more remorseful versus folks who are more defiant?
Remorse is a critical issue at sentencing. Let me talk about the juries first. The juries have convicted 100% of the January 6th defendants to go to trial by jury, at least partially, on some of the federal charges. They have not fully acquitted any January 6th defendants. The only one to be acquitted, the only one man to be acquitted for January 6th, went to trial by judge. But the juries aside, the judges make this emphatic at sentencing. If you've shown remorse for what you did that day and for the people injured and to the damage to democracy, the judges are going to take note of that. It may be part of their decision as to whether to show leniency. Richard Barnett's a great example. Richard Barnett did have some words of remorse, but the judge says Richard Barnett was remorseful for what happened to Richard Barnett and not to the injured police officers, not to the threat to democracy. Stuart Rhodes, that founder of the Oath Keepers sentenced yesterday, was simply unapologetic. No remorse, no words of concern for anyone. He actually used the platform of a sentencing hearing to reignite the political fires he's been lighting for years now. The judge made note of that. So remorse is critical. Words matter when you face a judge at sentencing.
The next seditious conspiracy sentencing that we're going to see, walk us through sort of the road ahead here and what you're watching for.
This really is the moment. This is the wave of the top line defendants facing justice and learning their punishments. The other four Oath Keepers, the far-right Oath Keepers convicted of seditious conspiracy, will be sentenced in the coming days, before the start of summer, basically. The four Proud Boys convicted of seditious conspiracy will be sentenced at the end of August or early September. They no doubt were closely watching what happened to Stuart Rhodes yesterday in the first seditious conspiracy case to go to sentencing. But all of this comes with a big asterisk, John. We have roughly 1,030 defendants. The Department of Justice has been unequivocal. There are hundreds more arrests still to come. And we don't know what to make of Jack Smith, the special counsel, and his investigation into January 6th. Will somebody else or some other people be charged? So
remind folks about his role and who assigned him and what his job is going to be.
The U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland decided that this January 6th investigation, or the investigation into efforts to overturn the 2020 election, needed a special counsel independent from the Attorney General himself to lead the investigation, the grand jury, and decide on charges. Jack Smith was the person designated to be the special counsel. He has not spoken publicly about his investigation. We can only do our own reporting into figuring out how it's been going and what's likely to happen next. We don't know if Jack Smith's going to charge anybody for efforts to overturn the 2020 election. We do know Jack Smith is also investigating the records seized from Mar-a-Lago, August 8th, 2022. So there's two different investigations at a minimum ongoing. We know the grand jury has been hearing from key witnesses inside the Trump inner circle. We don't know yet if Jack Smith's going to charge somebody for something with a nexus to January 6th, or if he'll charge many, many people with that.
Did the Stuart Rhodes case reveal any nexus to some of those folks that you're talking about?
We were waiting to hear that yesterday, if Stuart Rhodes, in his effort to get leniency from the judge, mentioned anything about whether he has been questioned or participating in any part of this investigation, whether he wanted to say something about Donald Trump or the Trump inner circle. Instead, from Stuart Rhodes, we got a more self-reverential, inflammatory political diatribe that was, again, unapologetic and may not have helped his cause at sentencing. We didn't get any tea leaves into the broader investigations that might be underway.
Do you think an 18-year sentence might change the mind of other folks who are convicted of seditious conspiracy to perhaps cooperate, look at that large number? Is this something that prosecutors are trying to do even in the weeks to come here?
I think defense attorneys will tell their clients about what happened with Stuart Rhodes yesterday and with other January 6th defendants who might have got a tougher sentence because they were, in a word, unapologetic. That's something I think many of these defendants are being counseled about. I have no doubt that Stuart Rhodes, defense attorneys, had some concern about what he was going to say yesterday and what he did say yesterday. All that being said, what the judge tried to make clear, John, was that he needs to be some deterrence, some general deterrence to prevent the recurrence of political violence after the next election. And the judge had his courtroom frozen and silent when he said this. He said, the country's holding their collective breaths right now, concerned about violence after the next election. Will there be another January 6th, he asked. This remains to be seen.
The courtroom. This obviously a big day in the courtroom for the January 6th cases. How often are those things happening down the street? Is this every day? You talk about 1,030 cases and more to come. Is this every day it's taking place down at the courthouse down there?
With the exception of holidays and weekends, multiple January 6th cases every single day, Monday mornings and Friday afternoons included. It's one of those things where they have to deal with this tonnage of cases, and there are updates before trial, updates after trial, status hearings, arraignments, preliminary hearings, plea hearings, and sentencings. It takes a lot of bandwidth.
How much of that is getting covered day to day by the media? I know you, somebody who has been on top of this more than most, but you know, on a day that a Stuart Rhodes is being sentenced, obviously a circus over there. What about the Monday or Tuesday when it's not a Stuart Rhodes case?
I find the smaller level, lower level cases equally illustrative, interesting, and important.
Why?
If you have somebody who comes in charged only with a misdemeanor, will he or she articulate how this person with no criminal past can be so galvanized, or in some people's minds, radicalized, to attack the U.S. Capitol? How does a grandma from the Midwest end up here? How does so many military members, including active duty military, end up here doing that? Teachers, medical professionals, how were they here? If you go and track their court cases, you may get some explanation and some indication, John, of how vibrant the risk is for a recurrence.
Give me two cases that stand out in your mind, not the Stuart Rhodes cases, not the most high profile, two of what you're talking about.
Let me go back to one we talked about earlier, Richard Barnett, who to a degree is a poster child for January 6th. He's that man from Arkansas who put his feet on Nancy Pelosi's office desk and left a vulgar note behind, convicted at trial. His trial showed the defiance of so many January 6th defendants, the way they continue to articulate their concerns about the 2020 election, continue to articulate their support for their political beliefs. And there was this moment, John, in court that so many of us will remember for quite a while. Barnett took the stand defiantly at his own trial. During cross-examination, the prosecutor cornered him and asked him, do you love the Bill of Rights? Richard Barnett says, love it. Do you love the First Amendment? Barnett says, love it. Do you love the Second Amendment? Barnett says, love it. Then the prosecutor asked, do you love the Third Amendment? Barnett says, love it. The prosecutor then asked, what is the Third Amendment? Barnett says, I don't know. The judge mentioned that during sentencing. It added this point. Mr. Barnett, you kind of had a trick question thrown at you, but recognize that what happens on January 6th is protected by the 12th Amendment, and you can't pick and choose which amendments you choose to follow. That moment crystallized what we see in so many smaller-level January 6th cases where the defendants in their court filings or sometimes at trial continue to show a strident political philosophy even in their own, even though it's been 2 years since January 6th and they're now facing the prospect of prison. One other one, the case of the QAnon shaman, Jacob Chansley, who I can report today has just been released from the federal prison in Arizona and a halfway house in Arizona. He was also one of the faces of January 6th. He became a bit of a political focal point in recent months, his case was, but he was in the Senate chamber. He was standing next to where Mike Pence was supposed to sit at the Senate president's desk. He served what some critics would say was a relatively short prison term. He's already been released. An indication that there's such a range from just a few months, just a few days, some people are sentenced to the 18 years Stuart Rhodes got.
By the way, the Third Amendment, just because you bring it up, no soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. We don't miss a chance to talk about the Constitution here.
No. And honestly, the judge said he had to look it up, too.
That was CBS News correspondent Scott McFarlane.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Next, 2024 Republican presidential candidate and former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson stopped by our Capitol Hill studios to talk about his campaign and how he plans to compete in an increasingly crowded GOP field.
2024 presidential candidate, former Governor of Arkansas, Asa Hutchinson, at our table this morning. Sir, thank you for being here.
You know, it's always good to be back on C-SPAN. And I remember when C-SPAN came to Arkansas while I was governor, it was special on your 50-state tour to host you, and it's good to be back.
Thank you very much. Let's talk about the latest candidate who's entered the race. This is from CNN's headline. Glitches, echoes, and melting the servers crashed DeSantis' campaign launch on Twitter. Your reaction?
It wasn't perfect, and I know Ron's probably disappointed that he didn't get more of his message out yesterday, but it's the very beginning parts of a campaign, and it's going to be a long slog for all of us, and so you pick up and you move on. And I'm excited that, this phase right now, you still have candidates entering the race. We entered about a month ago. You're probably going to have a couple more that perhaps will enter the race. And then you push toward the debates in August. And that's whenever you can really show some differences between the candidates. But we're off and running. Welcome Governor DeSantis to the race. And I think it's going to be a good one.
Many of the headlines with the governor entering the race compare him with the former president, Donald Trump. It appears that this is a two-man race, the way that this is being portrayed in the media. So how do you cut through?
Well, first of all, I don't see it as a two-man race at all. You got Donald Trump that is very high in the polls, and then you've got Ron DeSantis that has dropped significantly over the last 2 months, and he is in a second place. And then you've got another tier of candidates, including myself, that's in single digits, but we're moving in the right direction. We're moving up. And so I think it's a question as to who surfaces that will be the number one and number two and number three challenger to Donald Trump. You're looking at Iowa next presumably January, February timeframe in their caucus, will narrow the field as they historically do, might narrow it down to five, but and then you go on to New Hampshire and South Carolina, Nevada, and so on. And so it gradually narrows, but it's, you know, the media tries to make this a two-man race now. Well, who knows what it's going to look like a month from now? And so there's a long ways to go, and I think it's the job of the voters to narrow the field, and time will tell on that.
Where do you need to be? What are your metrics for staying in the race in the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary?
Well, first of all, my goal is to be in the race on Super Tuesday. That's when Arkansas will vote. Many of the southern states will vote. And so I expect to be alive and well and competing then. And that's why I was in South Carolina this last week. And even though we have Nikki Haley and Tim Scott from there, I went to college there in South Carolina. I've got roots there. And these are important territories to me and a great opportunity. So, sure, you focus on Iowa, which we are. In New Hampshire, we're going back to next week. But in the end, I want to be there long term. And so you ask about metrics. I do believe the candidates will self-evaluate as time goes on. And if you're building support, if you're raising the money that you need to keep in the game and keep alive, then you're going to go to actually where the votes count. And so don't expect people to be making decisions the next 2 or 3 months as to whether they're viable or not. This is going to be up to the voters.
Speaking of money, Nikki Haley, also in the race, raised around $8 million in her first few weeks. According to DeSantis's camp, they raised $1 million after their announcement yesterday. What is your cash looking like? What do your coffers look like?
Well, I'm not in the league of Donald Trump. And we're raising money. Very proud of the response that we're getting. I think the first report is due in July, so stay tuned on that. But
not going to share the number?
No, I'm not going to share the number. We're raising money, and it's aceat2024.com. help us get on the debate stage.
How do you differentiate yourself from, or how are you different from, the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis?
Well, first of all, I think that Governor DeSantis is following the model of Donald Trump. You know, it's the same pugilistic style. It is creating a little chaos. And, you know, we all, as governors, are problem solvers, but there's different ways that you do that. And so I believe that we need to be a fighter for our values, our consistent conservative principles. But at the same time, let's solve problems and do not create unnecessary conflicts. And for example, I disagree with the way that Governor DeSantis has taken on Disney. I disagree with what Disney said. But since when does government use the power of government to punish a business because they exercised free speech? To me, that's not America. It's not a conservative principle. And so we can disagree and we can even vote as consumers. I'm not going to go there. But to use the power of government to go after your largest employer or a significant employer in the state doesn't make sense to me. And so there's a disagreement as to what a conservative is. And when you use the power of government to accomplish a goal.
What are some other 2 to 3 other policy differences between you and the Florida governor and the former president?
Well, another one I will point out, though, is the differences on our support of Ukraine. You know, Governor DeSantis, of course, diminished it, has more of an isolationist view of the world, as does President Trump. And I believe the United States leadership is important in supporting Ukraine and bringing the European allies together to help us to oppose Russia in their aggression. Sure, we need to have accountable funds, we need to have audits, we need to have controls over it, but it is really important that we support them. And both Governor DeSantis and former President Trump have diminished that support. So that's a difference. And, you know, we're not trying to focus on those differences because we have many more differences with President Biden and his policies that's taken us the wrong direction. But those are a couple clear things that will come out in the debates, and I have disagreement with the way they've handled that.
Before we get to calls here, sir, how would you handle the debt talks that are happening between Speaker McCarthy and President Biden right now? Do you agree with Republicans on the spending cuts?
I agree with the Republicans that the president should agree to a framework for bringing the excessive federal spending under control. That is important, and President Biden should simply say yes to that. Yes, we're going to work together, and we're going to reduce spending down the road because it is in an uncontrollable state right now. You know, you can negotiate the terms of that framework, but it is important that you establish that framework for reducing spending.
Well, would you agree with this offer by the White House yesterday, which was to freeze spending for 2 years? That nonpartisan group estimates that that could cut deficits by as much as $1 trillion over the next decade. Would you take that offer?
Well, I'm not going to get into the nuances of that negotiation now. I think that the Republicans look at that and say, is this the right framework for controlling federal spending? And so give them the flexibility to negotiate that. What's important is that, one, we have to extend the debt. It's a legitimate debt of the United States. Secondly, we need to have a framework, some controls over spending in the future. This is what happened during the Obama years. And this is not perfect at all. Whatever they agree to is going to have some difficult challenges for our budget, but it's a necessary belt tightening. And so the lesson to me is start earlier. Let's try to avoid brinksmanship. And as president, I would try to work with Congress to make sure they pass their budgets, that they do their work early on, and that the president submits a budget on time as well. If you set that example, then we're not going to leave it to the end in terms of hurting our reputation across the globe as to whether the question is whether we're not going to pay our debts. That's not a good question even to ask or to be in the newspapers and in the media.
That was 2024 Republican presidential candidate Asa Hutchinson, a former Arkansas governor. Next, George Croner, a former principal litigation counsel at the National Security Agency, gives us a 101 on Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, a key government surveillance program that expires at the end of the year.
Section 702, it's supposed to sunset at the end of the year unless Congress votes to extend it. What does it allow the U.S. government to do, and how is it different from other types of, surveillance that the government is authorized?
Sure. What 702 allows the government to do is to target non-U.S. persons, foreigners, not U.S. persons, reasonably believed to be located outside of the United States. So they're outside of the domestic U.S. to acquire foreign intelligence information. It does that in and is implemented principally by the National Security Agency through a couple of surveillance techniques that it uses. But the critical distinction between Section 702, which frankly is a program that grew out of the post 9/11 intelligence issues and changes in the telecommunications environment that happened in the 21st century, how it differs from what I'll call traditional FISA, which was a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that was first passed by Congress in 1978, is that there is no warrant. There is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is the court that was established by the FISA Act, consisting of 11 U.S. District Court judges that serve in a secret compartmented facility in Washington, D.C., and they handle applications for court orders, both under traditional FISA, and they also handle certifications that are presented to them under Section 702. And the difference is, traditional FISA, your target is either a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. And you have to convince the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that there is probable cause to believe that the target is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power and is using the telecommunications facilities that you want to target to possess or transmit foreign intelligence information. So there's an individualized determination by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court based upon probable cause that the target is a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. Under 702, there is no probable cause hearing. There is no individualized targeting. Instead, because the targets are all foreigners who do not possess Fourth Amendment rights under the Constitution, the government instead submits a certification that describes various types of foreign intelligence information that the government is seeking to obtain by targeting individuals who they believe possess or transmit that type of foreign intelligence information. And that certification goes to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court with a series of procedures that are designed to protect U.S. citizens. And the reason those procedures were included and are included is Congress recognized when it created Section 702 in 2008 that if you're even if you're targeting and solely limited to targeting foreigners outside of the United States, there are U.S. persons communicating with those foreigners, that it was an inevitable byproduct of 702 collection, that U.S. person communications would be, in fact, collected. The term used is incidentally collected as part of the 702 collection program, which, as I say, does not involve individualized probable cause determinations with respect to those individuals, foreign individuals who are targeted. So without that probable cause hearing, without that individualized targeting determination by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the law instead says that we have this set of procedures. They're called targeting procedures, minimization procedures, and querying procedures, along with something called the Attorney General's Acquisition Guidelines. And those procedures are designed to serve as a proxy for the warrant requirement that would otherwise exist under Title I of FISA, or, for example, Title III, which is the law enforcement analog of electronic surveillance to FISA.
Okay.
So those procedures were created, and 702 collection proceeds, as I say, without any individualized targeting determination. There is, as I say, significant incidental collection of U.S. person communications.
Okay.
That was George Croner, former principal litigation counsel at the National Security Agency and senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.